Thanks for having me today. It's actually a real pleasure to be here because one of the obsessions that I had actually in the latter days of Shazam was data. I had a few kind of personal projects that I would take on my own time, and one of them was like, hey, we have some really amazing data, and of course we were doing some things which I'll tell you about to monetize that, but I felt like we were very, very sort of missing the mark in terms of the opportunity. We never actually got to some of the stuff that I was proposing because we ended up with an acquisition with Apple, but I can absolutely relate to the enthusiasm and the excitement of all the things you can do with data. But today I thought I'd actually kind of veer off a little bit from data and tell you the story of creating Shazam, because I think it's a great story that really illustrates sometimes what it's like to have an idea that you're very passionate about, but face so many things, so many obstacles that make it seem impossible, and having to overcome that and push through that. So a little background on Shazam, just for perspective. I assume most of you are familiar with the app. It's a company we actually founded in London in 2000, four co-founders, and we got to over a billion downloads. We've had raised over $140 million of venture capital through the life of Shazam, and that ended after 18 years with a wonderful outcome with Apple buying Shazam, closing in 2018. And you see a quote that I put on there to kind of illustrate some of the things that we had to overcome. This is a quote from one venture capitalist that when we pitched and showed him our demo of Shazam, and that word for word, he said, "I don't see why anyone would ever use that." Quite a famous venture capitalist. So I'll start with the inception of Shazam, where I was living in London, and I had a couple friends I wanted to start a company with, and we were brainstorming different ideas, and we just thought, we just know we want to start a company. And we went through all kinds of different crazy ideas and met at cafes and kind of thought through the different things that we could do and what would be a viable business. But one thing that was irking me was this need to know what music was when you heard it. Because I would hear songs that I liked in many different environments, sometimes in a cafe or a movie theater, watching TV, listening to the radio while I'm driving, so many different places. And I would try to find out a song once in a while. A song would really move me. And I would try to find out what it was from someone, and then I would add it to a little playlist. And I made something that was called back then a miscellaneous tape, a mixtape. So I had this need. I thought, gosh, I really need something that can just tell me what the song is at the moment that I hear it. And so that became the passion and the focus of what we would do to create this new business with Shazam. And for a little background on Shazam, by the way, it's actually a word that means to conjure magic. And so we thought, like, wow, if people are going to hold their phone in the air and then just boom, it's going to tell them the name of the song that's in the ambient environment around them, that's like magic. And so what a great name that would be for the business. So our vision was actually that Shazam was not just a feature, but an entire business, an entire product suite. So we believe there's this thing called the music moment. It's that moment that I described when you're moved by a piece of music, something that really moves you, and you think, wow, what is this song? I really love this song. And that could happen in many different places, as I mentioned, movie theaters, cafes, shopping malls, even laundromats. And we believe that when you connected with a song, we would be that connecting point, and then you could do all the things you want to do with that song. So you could find out the name of the artist, obviously, but also add it to a playlist, send it to a friend, read the discography on the artist, see the album cover of the artist, look at the video of the artist. So just all the things that you'd want to do with music, it would be the kind of connecting point between you and the music in your world, in your daily life. But we faced so many challenges because we had this wonderful idea, but to actually make it a reality was pretty challenging. The first challenge that we had is that we took this concept and we researched. We thought, well, what kind of technologist would invent this technology? And it turned out that the type of technologist that would invent it was someone with a PhD in electrical engineering that had focused specifically in audio signal processing. So we reached out to people with this expertise, and we found that there were two programs in the United States at top universities where there were PhDs that were specialized in this area, music, audio, signal processing, PhDs in electrical engineering. And those two programs were Stanford and MIT Media Lab. So we went to the professors, and we went to the PhD students there that were specialized in this area, and we said, this is our concept. Can you please figure out how to invent it for us? And they all said that, as far as they know, this is impossible. And they had no idea how to invent such a technology. They knew that it didn't exist. What did exist was music recognition in a nice, clean environment. So, for example, scanning across digital files of music on the internet or listening to clean signals from radio play. Because that was a relatively easy problem. There was already a company that was monitoring all radio play, of which there's about 100,000 songs in play. But when we introduced the scale that we wanted to achieve, so all music, and the noise, the ambient noise that comes over the mobile phone, when you combine noise and scale in the field of pattern recognition, then the problem becomes incredibly difficult. And so for a while we were wondering whether we should just give up, because we had no idea. We really wanted to build this business, but these people that were 1,000 times smarter than us and specialized in the area were telling us that it was impossible and there was no known way to do it. We made a list of people that had published papers in this area of audio signal processing and music, and we found this professor at Stanford named Julius Smith, who became our advisor. And we sat down with him one day, and we said, here's a list of 30 names, and he knew them all. Can you please help us rank the 5 smartest guys? Because what we want to do is approach them and try to recruit them as a co-founder of Shazam. And so this is the notes from that meeting. And the number one ranked guy, Avery Wang, with 4 degrees from Stanford in mathematics, electrical engineering, PhD in this audio signal processing, joined as our 4th co-founder. But the next problem is that once he had joined the company, he also thought it was impossible. And he really just didn't know what to do. He wanted to give up. And you can see all the challenges that we faced. So we had noise in the background. We had voice compression, where mobile phones would compress sound and chop off the top and the bottom of the spectrum. We had noise cancellation technologies built onto mobile phones that emphasize the human voice and de-emphasize all other sounds, including music. Speed variation, such as when DJs change the speed of music. Pitch correction, when DJs change the speed of music and then use digital technology to adjust the pitch, a nonlinear transformation of the music. Reverberation, such as you get in rooms like this. Poor speakers, and all kinds of computational and statistical challenges around scaling. So the problem just seemed insurmountable. And this will give you a sense for what we had to overcome. So I'm going to play for you just a 15-second clip of a song. And now I'll play for you what we would capture over a mobile phone from someone recording that exact same 15 seconds of that song out in a bar. So you can see why we were very nervous and why these professors and PhDs were saying, we have no idea how to do this. But luckily, the professor and our co-founder, Avery, worked very hard to come up with an approach, and they one day cracked the code and came up with an approach to solve this problem. And it was a three-dimensional graph of spectral peaks, which are basically energy peaks of sound graphed against time and frequency and plotted for every piece of music. So actually, it wasn't even music identification. It was actually recorded sound identification. So that means it could work just as well for someone trying to identify a television commercial that has sound as it would for music, as long as there was a recording of the sound. But then, of course, now we had a technology, a patent, and a demo running off a laptop computer. But the year was 2000, and the dot-com bubble had popped. Companies were filing bankruptcy, and venture capitalists were fighting fires for their portfolio companies, and they definitely were terrified of making new investments in consumer startups that required lots of funding and marketing to get to critical mass. So we went out and we pitched to not 5 or 10 or 15, but over 110 venture capital firms in London. And they basically all said no. Until finally one said yes. And then when they said yes, they said, we will only invest if you get two more VCs to invest. CYA. So then we finally had to then go keep convincing VCs until we got two more to invest. And finally, we got IDG Ventures Europe and Virgin's Venture Fund, Lynx Capital Partners, and a little voice recognition-focused fund called FLV out of Belgium. And those three venture capitalists put the $7.5 million down to help us build this business. But now, the next challenge that we face is just how far ahead of our time we were. Because just think that we were trying to build this music recognition service, and even the iPod was not available yet. iTunes was not available. It was 2 to 3 years away. So there was no market for downloading songs and building a business around that. And of course, the iPhone was 7 years away. And here we are talking about advanced mobile phone applications. So that meant that all the things that we envisioned as this wonderful user experience were not feasible. You couldn't have apps and album cover arts and download music songs over 3G networks and show discography and lyrics and share with friends. All these things that we envisioned were in our presentation were things that were many years away from being feasible simply because mobile phones couldn't do it. And then, of course, whenever you build a business like this in mobile phones, you actually have to get out to users. Users have to be able to find you. And the App Store was 8 years away. So we had no mechanism for making people aware of our service and enabling people to get access to it easily. And you can imagine how impossible this seems. Imagine trying to build a Shazam business, and this is the most popular phone that year. And all the phones are like this. They all have monochrome screens with about 40 by 50 pixels. And they all don't run apps, and they all don't stream music. This is what we had to work with. And so the way Shazam worked when we launched, because we had to work with the existing technologies, is that you dialed a four-digit phone number on your phone. For us, that number was the only four-digit number that's in a straight line on that keypad. 2580 down the middle of the phone, so it would be somewhat memorable. And you dial that number, you held your phone up, it made a voice phone call to an interactive voice response system. We recorded 15 seconds of sound, we ended the call, and we sent a text message to your phone with the name of the song. And that's how Shazam launched in 2002. And our first market was the UK. But of course, to build this business, there was more we had to do. Because at that time, there was no AWS. And so if we wanted to build a search engine like Google, we literally had to call Google engineers and asked them, you know, how do you build your search engine? They said, well, we build this Beowulf cluster of parallel processing PCs and run searches across the RAM that are incredibly fast. And so we had to build from the ground up the same kind of technology. We built a Beowulf cluster of PCs that you can see here, stacked PCs, and in the RAM of these PCs, we housed the fingerprints of all the music. And every time someone called in, we ran that search in hundredths of a second across all those PCs, all built from scratch by our engineers. And then, of course, as Jeff Bezos would know, what can you do without having everything? And how can a music recognition service work if you don't actually have all the music to identify? And we had a vision that you would be able to identify everything. So we found out that in the UK market, there are, if you went to the largest record store in the UK at the time, it was on Oxford Street in London, HMV and Virgin Megastore. If you went into those stores, bought one of every single CD, and walked out of the store, you'd have 15,000 CDs. But if you went to the biggest distributor of CDs in the UK, and you would have access to all their CDs, you would have 100,000 CDs. And so we decided we wanted to have 100,000 CDs of music at launch, which is about 1.7 million songs of music. And to give you perspective, Shazam now has well over 40 or 50 million songs of music. So how are we going to do that? Because they're all on CDs. So we did the obvious thing. We built our own software that allows you to put a CD into a computer, and it removes, rips all the fingerprints of the music from the CD. And then we hired about 30 18-year-olds to work 3 8-hour shifts a day, 24 hours a day, putting CDs into computers and typing the name of every song, every album, every artist to build this database from scratch, because there was no digital database that we could get access to. And so we literally co-located those people at the site of the biggest distributor in the UK of CDs, overcoming the impossible. And so finally, here are my two co-founders, two of my three co-founders. We celebrated, we launched in the summer of 2002. And we were so excited because, of course, we're going to have millions of users, and it's just going to spread like wildfire. And people are just going to love this service so much, and they're just going to all tell each other about it. And we're going to be raking in hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. But the reality is that in this environment where you have to get the message out to people, that they have to dial a phone number, there's no app store, no rich experience, no app behavior, and the only thing you could do on mobile phones at the time was make voice phone calls and send text messages. So just training people that there's other things you could do on a mobile phone was just too costly for us. And so despite spending a few million dollars on marketing with radio ads that would play the last advertising spot just before the song and tell you to try Shazam, TV ads, billboards, banner ads, even people that we hired to walk into bars and tell people about this service, none of that stuff works at the scale that we needed. And so we burned our funds, we suffered, we laid off people, and for six years from our launch in 2002 until the world of mobile changed in 2008, we barely survived. And then 2008 happened. The App Store launched on the iPhone, and Shazam was in the first few apps in that launch, and it was just instantaneous success. Now, of course, it's a small number of mobile phones, but it just remained in the top apps of all time in downloads. And I remember checking the rankings about every 2 hours because I was obsessed. I thought, finally, after all these years, I knew this would happen. And then Shazam skyrocketed. And today, approaching 200 million monthly active users, over a billion downloads, used, you know, recognized by even the famous artists as being an influencer of what people do, when they listen to music and how they discover music. So incredibly satisfying. So some learnings for us, including, of course, a couple around data. So one thing that we learned is that actually Shazam data is actually interesting. It actually predicts hits even before radio play, radio rankings, and sales. And so we were actually able to package this data up and sell it to major record labels. And that was a small but growing business for Shazam. It even could be useful for planning tours, as artists actually make more of their money now from the tours than from selling the music, and trying to figure out which cities they should go to based on where people are Shazamming the artist was something that we did with a few different famous artists. And we built a business in advertising. Advertising actually became our core revenue stream for Shazam as the world of downloads started to decline. And we enabled advertisers to make their advertisements clickable, Shazammable. So a TV ad, you could Shazam a TV ad, you could Shazam a radio ad, you could Shazam even a billboard using some of our image recognition and so on. And so we built this business. And of course, one of the most interesting things to all these advertisers was the data they would get when they would see where their users are, where their customers are, where what people are doing, what the engagement looks like. And that became a big fuel for this dream that we had of building an entirely new advertising business for Shazam. Another learning for me was the importance of simplicity and how sometimes the best simplicity can be incredibly complex. So after Shazam, while I remained on the board, I went and joined Google, where I spent almost 8 years. And after that, I went to Dropbox, where I spent almost 4 years. And what's fascinating to me about the commonality between Shazam, Google, and Dropbox is that in all cases, they create an experience for users that's very simple. A search box, you type something in, and you get the answer. You know, a folder, you drag something in, and it's in the cloud. And of course, Shazam, a button you push, and you find out the music. But what's behind that incredibly simple one-step experience for users is incredibly complex technology in all three cases. And it's that obsession with wanting to solve that technological challenge and create this incredible output that is so simple for users. That's what leads to the great success for those companies. And another learning through all the years of plowing through and trying to get Shazam from that initial idea in 2000 all the way to an acquisition by Apple in 2018 is persistence and just sticking it out every day for years and years. And even during my full-time jobs at Google and Dropbox as a board member of Shazam, I think I put 15 hours a week into Shazam trying to think of things that we could do, projects such as monetizing data, that it would help make Shazam more successful. And so this mathematical equation or truth shows what happens when you put that extra 1% in every day in a year and what the difference is compared to putting in just 99% every day. It's tremendous over time. And this is really what led, I believe, to Shazam eventually reaching its success despite so many years of near bankruptcy. And of course, one last lesson, the greatest pleasure in life is doing what people say you cannot do. And I have to admit that I did reach out to that venture capitalist. And I remember when Apple published in their second or third year of the App Store, they said, here are the top most downloaded apps. And there you see companies like Google and Google Maps and Skype and Shazam. And so I emailed them and I just said, turns out people will use this. And he came out, had lunch with me at Google, and we had a good laugh about how hard it is to predict the future. Incredibly satisfying moment for an entrepreneur. And so I always like to wrap up with this television commercial from Apple from way back in the day. Does anyone remember this commercial? A couple people? Yeah, a few people. But there's always some people that haven't seen it, and it's just such an inspiring commercial. And it really represents, I think, anyone from whatever field you're coming from, whether you're from entertainment field and actors and actresses and sports athletes and entrepreneurs, and you know, if you're even when you're building, trying to get gatherings around the importance of data, and people are not necessarily listening to you and believing you, sometimes you feel like you have to overcome what this sort of people thinking that you're crazy, and that's what this commercial conveys. So let me just play this for you. Steve Jobs' voice in the background.
Here's to the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the troublemakers, the round pegs in the square holes, the ones who see things differently. They're not fond of rules, and they have no respect for the status quo. You can quote them, disagree with them, glorify or vilify them. About the only thing you can't do is ignore them, because they change things. They push the human race forward. While some may see them as the crazy ones, we see genius. Because the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Chris Barton, ladies and gentlemen, thank you, Chris. That was great. So many good things in there. You know, look, I wish we could do Q&A. We have to move on. And thank